When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Welcome to the Intercooler Podcast.
Hi everyone, welcome to episode 189 of the Intercooler Podcast. I'm Dan Prosser, Andrew Frankel is my co-host. This week we're talking about the people from the world of cars and racing who we have most enjoyed meeting over the years. Some of them you will have heard of, others I suspect you won't have heard of at all. And we also share a couple of people who perhaps were a disappointment to meet. So that's coming in a moment. But before we do that, I'm going to remind you all, because it's Christmas season, that you can give a subscription to the Intercooler as a gift. You can choose between 6, 12 and 24 month gift subscriptions, starting at just £35.99. If you choose the 24 month option, you save 16% on the standard cost. We send you a digital gift voucher immediately, which you can share digitally with the recipient, or you can print it out and put it in a card. So it's really easy to do. You don't have to go and queue up anywhere, battle all the other Christmas shoppers. It's really simple. We think it's a great gift. Just head to the-intercooler.com/gift-subscriptions and you'll see the three gifting options there. You can just head to the homepage and find the gifts page. I'll also put a link in the description of this episode. So, if you're looking for the perfect gift for the petrol head in your life, think about a subscription to the Intercooler. Right, let's get on with this week's podcast. Importantly, this topic, Andrew, is more about the people we have really enjoyed meeting. It's not necessarily the most famous people or the biggest names or the people we've been most privileged to meet. And actually, in my case, I've got a couple of people who our listeners might never have heard of, but I've thoroughly enjoyed meeting them. I think just because we don't want to leave people shortchanged, we're going to have to do a couple of people we haven't enjoyed meeting so much. I've only got one, I reckon, but hopefully you can do a bit better.
Yeah, I can probably rustle up a few.
Now, this isn't going to be a bragathon. This is not about the superstars we've been privileged enough to meet. But let's just get that out of the way. Conventionally speaking, who do you think the most famous person you've met in this sort of line of work is?
Well, the obvious one that springs to mind is Senna.
Oof, blimey.
I wouldn't say
How many Instagram followers would he have now? Quite a lot.
Quite a lot, but I couldn't say that. I mean, so most of the people, I would say all of the people on my list, whether they're well-known or not, and some are and some aren't, are people. They're not just people that I met and never saw again. I mean, if you went up to Senna a week after I saw him and said to him, who's Andrew Frankel? He wouldn't have had a clue, even though I spent an afternoon with him. These are all people that I can say that I know. So him and other people that I can say that I know, and who equally would know me, I guess Rowan Atkinson. Because he and I, and Sterling, obviously, while he was with us, Sterling was, you know, a close friend. Rowan is absolutely not, but we've raced old cars together. We did a bit of work together once on something. And, you know, we've had a number of conversations and, you know, we've stuff like that. So he's, I guess Rowan is probably the most famous person alive today who I could say that I know a tiny bit.
Okay, so I clearly don't know either of these two, but I have met them and had brief conversations with them. Keanu Reeves and Matt LeBlanc, who, I mean, Hollywood actors, but they're sort of tied into the car world in some way. Keanu Reeves, well, he's got a motorbike company. I think it's called Arch Motorcycles. And, of course, he did the Braun documentary recently. Matt LeBlanc, I met him on the Top Gear set. And actually, the funny thing about Matt LeBlanc is that we somehow got on to talking about old Mercedes, and he started reeling off W numbers.
There you go. You could always tell people know their W. It's like people who know their E numbers with BMWs. Then you just see that you suddenly, if someone could tell their E36 from their E46, and their W123s from the W124s, you just know they know, don't they?
Yeah, he clearly knew. It was unbelievable, actually. He clearly knew much better than I did.
Yeah.
So that is a car guy.
Also, hang on. Our mutual friend Chris Harris, who talks very honestly to the likes of you and I about who he does and doesn't get on with, he really rates LeBlanc, doesn't he? I've never met him, but he really rates LeBlanc. He thinks he's a genuinely proper person.
Yeah. I think he loves him, actually. So must be a decent guy. God, I think you're going to absolutely school me with this topic.
I think it was your idea.
It was my idea. Okay, well, I'm going to hand the baton over to you to get us started then with someone you've enjoyed meeting.
Well, I mean, are we talking about industry folk? Or, I mean, I've probably got 10 drivers down here.
It's easy to default to drivers, isn't it?
It's very easy to default to drivers. Okay, this guy's a driver, and I've known him for a long time, but I wouldn't say that I know him well. But he's someone that a lot of people will have heard of, but absolutely not everybody, because although he's a driver and he's one of the most gifted drivers I've ever been driven by, he's not a name. He's not famous as a racing driver. I give you Mr. Raffaele Di Simone.
Oh yeah, fantastic. You're probably at Fiorano, aren't you?
I am at Fiorano. This is Ferrari's. He's the bloke who they always wheel out when they're launching a new fast car at Fiorano. And out comes Rafa, and he takes you around in the car for a few laps, makes you feel thoroughly inadequate, while he's quietly sitting there, you know, one hand on the steering wheel, explaining the various functions while drifting the car at 140 miles an hour, and you just come away from it feeling utterly useless. But he's also just a lovely, lovely guy, and he listens. He's not one of these guys, because he's in a position where he's got the information and you need it, where he's therefore always on transmit. He's always asking. And he's good enough to look like he actually means it. He's always asking you about the car and what you think. And also, when he sees you, he goes, I'm not going to do the accent. You know, hi, Andrew, it's been a while. What have you been up to? And maybe he's just been to chance call. I think he's just a really good bloke.
Yeah, he's a very cool guy, actually. Do you know anything about his background? I've never looked into what he raced or what sort of level he got up to.
Well, I mean, I think like lots of those guys, and I've had conversations with people who are, I mean, you know, Matt Becker, who's another guy who's actually on my list. The very famous Lotus, Aston Martin, now JLR, and was almost briefly McLaren chassis engineer. I think I was standing in a signing on queue at Snetterton for some race I was doing, and saw Matt in the queue and said, what are you doing? You know, I think he was racing a Fiesta or something. and, you know, he must have been, maybe in his early 30s or something. And I said, you know, you must get to race all sorts. And he said, no, this is the first race I've ever done.
Wow.
Because his entire life is spent driving cars on tracks. And I think Rafa has done a lot. I can't remember. I think he's done some Italian touring cars. Maybe he's done some GT3, that sort of stuff. I don't know. But I think when you say to him, why aren't you off, you know, racing prototypes? He said, well, because I'm here. And he gets to drive everything Ferrari that produces. And, you know, that's probably enough to be going on with.
Yeah, he's a cool guy. And you're right. Whenever you jump out of one of his cars, he comes over and asks you what you think. And he listens, which is interesting because there's nothing we can tell him about his cars. But he actually genuinely is interested in our point of view. And he knocks around Maranello and Modena in an ancient Fiat 500. And he just seems like a cool guy.
He's a dude. Yeah.
Yeah, he is. All right, I'll go. So this was a very sort of structured, formal, roundtable interview thing at Red Bull Racing at the factory with Daniel Ricciardo and Max Verstappen. So this is 2018, just before the British Grand Prix, when Aston Martin was involved in that team. It's weird to think, isn't it, that there was that tie-in and now they're actually rivals in Formula One.
Yeah.
And the point about meeting those two, and they were sort of one after the other, but they overlapped and they were in the same room for a little while. There were no surprises. They were exactly like they seem on television. Now, I don't know, maybe they were just in sort of media mode and they always are when they're on television. But you got exactly what you expected from both of them. So Ricciardo was very talkative, very easygoing, jokey, but also, you know, he gave considered answers to your questions and detailed answers. He seemed to want to help you do a good job. He told us all about his Aston Martin Valkyrie that he had on order. And actually, I remember him eyeing up the cookies on the table, the far end of the table. And he was sort of umming and ahhing about having one. And eventually he decided that he would have a cookie. But he just sort of came across as like actually just a normal bloke, I suppose. And then Verstappen, the opposite, maybe not the opposite, but very, very different. It's not that he was rude or unpleasant, but he was straight to the point. He was very brusque. He sort of, you know, perfunctory answers to questions.
Gave the impression of not wanting to be there?
Yeah, like he couldn't get out quickly enough.
Yeah.
Who knows? Maybe he just doesn't hold journalists in very high regard, which is fair enough. I suspect plenty of them have given him a hard time in the past.
I have seen this a couple of times. You know, when you are, well, the couple of, well, Senna was one. And Sebastian Loeb was another, whose in public persona compared to their in private persona it's like flicking a switch.
Mm.
It's like flicking a switch, and they go from being exactly what you say, very brusque, direct, short, curt, not quite rude, but getting towards that way. And then you get them on their own, and I only spent, you know, very small periods of time on my own with either Senna or Loeb, but they just, I mean, you would not. You know, if they didn't inhabit the same body, you wouldn't have recognised them.
Mm, I'm sure.
So who knows? I mean, I don't know anyone who knows Max personally. So I don't know what the answer to that question is. Maybe he's like that in private, but who knows?
Yeah, no, I agree. All right, let's have one of yours then.
Okay, so now I think I'm going to have to do a grouping.
Yeah.
Because I just got so many names here. So I'm going to group together a load of what I would call more senior British racing drivers, mainly coming from the sort of sports car arena. So in this group, we have Derek Bell, we have Richard Attwood, we have Brian Redman, and we have David Hobbs. I don't know David that well, I know him a bit. All the others I know reasonably well. And they're just all uniformly utterly brilliant people.
Mm.
They are so funny. they are so full of fantastic stories. And, I mean, it's like I pay to see him on stage. They're just, when they're relaxed, and Sterling was the same when he was relaxed, and he was another person with a rather different private to public persona. But these guys actually just do it just as well, whether they've got a crowd of, you know, thousands or it's just you talking to them. They're just such amazingly good company. They take the piss out of each other relentlessly and all wear it in very good humour. I'm a bit in awe of them still because they're all in their sort of, you know, probably all in their 80s now. I think they are all in their 80s now. Mm. In fact, they are all in their 80s now. But I know what they did and the kinds of things that they drove and the risks that they took and the places that they're and the friends that they lost. And I can't quite divorce all that from the genial old bloke having a chat. I'm having a chat with. So I'm in awe of all of them. Of them all, Richard Atwood's the one I know easily the best. And he and I are genuinely good buddies. And he is one of the funniest. He's one of the funniest people. He's one of the most dryly funny people you'll ever meet. And he is so modest. He's so understated. And Derek Bell. I spent a bit of time with Derek actually this year in at the Rennsport Porsche event at Monterey. I think Derek's 82 now. He looks about 52. And he's just... We got to the stage with him where he kind of like trusts you. And there are lots of other people on this list, actually not racing drivers, maybe they're industry executives or whatever, that your relationship with them has developed to a point where they don't have to say, oh, this is off the record, or I'm not going to tell you that. They just tell you because they know that you know where to draw the line and to not let them down. And I can remember I was in the back of a car with Derek traveling from the hotel we were both staying in up to Monterey. And he was just talking about getting old and his family being a bit concerned with, you know, as I think we all are, you know, if we have parents who may loosely be described as, you know, as elderly and they're still trying to race cars and do that sort of thing. There's a natural sort of concern there. And he was sort of, you know, he was getting a bit sort of gruff about it in a rather sort of touching solicitor's kind of way. And I just remember sitting there thinking it's very nice that he feels he can just sit in the back of a car and chat with me about this sort of thing. And he is a lovely, lovely guy. And, you know, if you think that, you know, works Ferrari Formula One driver, obviously works Porsche driver all the way through the Group C era, 5 Le Mans wins, all the stuff that he's done. And yet he hasn't turned into a twat. And I think sports car drivers, I think, are a very special breed because they have to share. They have to think about other people because you wouldn't be very good at your job if you didn't. If you just brought the car back every time in bits with things hanging off it, you wouldn't be a sports car driver for very long. So you have to be considerate. And as a breed, I mean, I don't know, like you don't. I know you know lots of rally drivers. I don't know rally drivers at all, really. But as a breed, sports car drivers are by and large a brilliant bunch. I'm not sure I ever met one I really didn't like. I met a few Formula One drivers I didn't like. But yeah, so that lot.
Do you know, I knew that hearing you talk would remind me of some people that I've really thoroughly enjoyed meeting.
Oh, I'm terrified of the people I'm not going to mention.
I know. They're going to come to us later on in the week, aren't they? And we're going to think, goodness me, how did I forget that person? But you have just reminded me of Martin Brundle. you were talking about grouping people in together. And imagining these people taking the piss out of one another and just having a great time.
Yeah.
Every year, and I think it's probably around now, you know, coming up to Christmas, what do they call themselves? The Rat Pack? The likes of Brundle, Damon Hill, Johnny Herbert,
Blundell.
Mark Lundell.
Yeah.
Those guys, they all get together for a Christmas meal, don't they? And you see the picture on Twitter. But I'm sure they just have a great time just reminissing and...
Taking the piss out of each other.
Yeah. Yes. But yeah, I had dinner with Brundle and just a couple of other people in Mexico City before the Mexico Grand Prix. I was out there with Jaguar to drive the stunt car from the new James Bond film, Spectre.
Yeah.
You know, the CX-75 Jaguar stunt car. And the Jaguar PR people just invited Brundle to come have dinner with us on the Thursday evening or something. And he said, yes, okay. And so there I was in this lovely restaurant in Mexico City, sitting opposite Martin Brundle, just thinking, how has this happened? But then he's so talkative, so easy to just chat to. And within minutes, he was telling me all about racing Ayrton Senna in British Formula 3.
Yeah.
And for a motorsport fan, for a car guy, you know, forget that I wasn't a journalist then. I was just a fan.
Yeah.
And it was fantastic. And the thing that he told me about Senna was that even in that year, he knew Ayrton Senna was a bit different, a bit special. And this was when he was trying his damnedest to beat the guy in Formula 3. And he was the only one who could get anywhere near him. And you would think that maybe, just to try and give himself some sort of psychological advantage, he might pretend to himself during that year that Senna was overrated or whatever. But actually, none of it. He knew the bloke was special.
Yeah.
And so it proved to be.
Yeah, I actually had exactly that with Jonathan Palmer, who's another bloke who I know. Yeah. I know Jonathan really pretty well. And I think one of the things that I found was exactly that. He said exactly the same thing about when Jean Lacy became his teammate in the very early days of telemetry. And, you know, he's, you know, Formula One drivers, they're meant to have these massive egos. And I remember just saying to me that, you know, the first time they saw his traces overlaid with the Lacy's, he just thought, well, that's it. I can't do that.
Wow. Boof.
And the self-awareness.
Yeah.
But then again, you know, guys like Jonathan and Martin in particular. I got to know Martin when he was racing Bentleys 20 years ago. And I was sort of seconded to the team to write a book. And so I've kind of known him a bit then and ever since. But I mean, I can remember sitting in team debriefings where Martin has, you know, they've been testing somewhere and they sent him out on a set of tyres. And he'd done 40 laps or whatever, and he's come back, and he literally almost gives them a lap-by-lap download. They've got all the telemetry, and they'll be sitting there and go, oh, you're a three-tenths down there. He said, yeah, I know, but I ran wide at turn four, whatever. And it's all in there.
Wow.
And it is. And the other thing with these very intelligent people, particularly someone like Martin was also massively into road cars. He asks questions. It's not always a one-way street, me going, so, oh, what was it like to race centre? He'll say, oh, have you driven the such and such? What's it like? And he'll really want to know. And he's also, because he's just a complete petrol head. And if you find yourself in the company of someone who shares your passion, it's always easy, isn't it? Because you can tell and they can tell, and you're kindred spirits. And yeah, and, you know, although Martin, you know, has gone on to achieve the most. Oh, see, Murray. You see, Murray is another one. I didn't have Murray Walker on my list. It's terrible. I'm going to wish I'd never done this.
Yeah, they're going to keep coming. We'll do a second episode.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, absolutely. Right, okay, move on.
I'm going to do one that people will not have heard of, I'm confident. A chap called Carsten Shebstadt.
Including me.
There you go. German chassis engineer, vehicle dynamics engineer. Brilliant, brilliant engineer. He was at Porsche when, you know, around the time of the 997 GT3 and the GT3 RS.
Yeah.
So he was involved in engineering those cars.
So he was a Preuninger protege.
He's a Preuninger guy, yeah.
Yeah. And he's not a bloke on my list.
I met him. Yeah, I met him when he was working at VW. I think he's still at VW. He does the sporty stuff, so the GTIs and the Golf R's and so on. And I knew that we were in a Volkswagen Touareg prototype somewhere in Spain, I think. And it was a long road route. Me, him, two other guys. We had a long way to go. And I knew he had worked with Walter Roll, one of my heroes. And so I just said to him, tell me your best Walter story. And he delivered a stone-cold classic. It was such a good story. I got my phone out, hurriedly noted it down on the notes app on my phone, just in very shorthand. And then I screenshotted it and posted those on Twitter. And that tweet went about as viral in my own minor way as anything I've ever done has gone.
Yeah,
because it was such a great tale. And I thought, actually, I'd just read it very quickly now. Remember, this is purely in note form. Porsche engineers were benchmarking the 997 GT2 at the Nürburgring in 2007. They had a Lamborghini Gallardo Superleggera and a Ferrari 599 GTB. Walter Roll was setting the lap times. He went out in the Lamborghini first, then the Ferrari. When he came back from setting the lap time in the 599, he had a huge smile on his face, according to one of the engineers, Carsten. The engineer asked him what he was smiling about. Roll explained that halfway around the lap, he had seen another 599 in front of him, a few corners ahead, and he said to himself, I will catch that other 599. So for the second half of the lap, Walter Roll steadily gained on that leading car until, at the final corner going on to the long main straight, the leading car had a big oversteer moment. Roll squeezed through on the inside into the lead. Having got to the paddock, Roll drove onto the public road to cool the brakes down. The second Ferrari followed and pulled alongside. They both stopped. Roll lowered his window. The other 599 lowered its window to reveal its driver, Michael Schumacher. He said to Roll, I had to see who was quicker than me. Now I see it's you, it's okay with me. Later that evening, in the Pistenklaus, the story was doing the rounds. At some point, the Sachs engineers, who had been working, doing some suspension tuning work with Schumacher that day, arrived. They said he was furious when he got back to the garage. He instructed the engineers to check every nut and bolt on the car, refusing to accept that Roll had been quicker.
Wow.
That's from Carsten Shebstadt.
That's
just amazing
tale,
that these things go on, isn't it? I just think it's fantastic.
Chasing Schumacher around the ring. Yeah, I mean, it's... But you can believe it. You can see it happening, can't you?
Credit to Schumacher for being gracious, at least in Roll's company. You know, that can't have been easy. But actually, it leads me on to another one. It follows on, because Walter Roll is absolutely on my list of people I've thoroughly enjoyed meeting. He can actually seem quite shy, even when you're talking to him. Maybe there's an almost nervous air about him. But we were up in Scotland for the launch of the 718 Cayman GT4 a few years ago. He's a two-time World Rally Champion, hero to me. And so I was very lucky to get to be driven around Knockhill for several laps in a Cayman GT4, which is a hell of an experience. What's interesting is that he's so unflustered and driving so quickly, it must all just seem actually quite tame to him. You know, it's not a very powerful, very quick car. It's a fairly fiddly circuit, but you're not going to hit anything, really, compared to a rally stage. So he's so within himself. And after the handful of laps, we pulled into the paddock. And I knew, I just wanted to try and get another story out of him, because I knew he'd have something. And I asked him about the Carrera GT, which he was lead development driver for that car. And he told me about this occasion at the Nürburgring, again, I think it was around 2004. The magazine, I can't remember which magazine it was, actually, one of the big German car magazines, set up a test where all the main big German car companies took their latest high-performance cars with a professional driver to demonstrate them and to set lap times, and they would all drive one another's cars. And, you know, Audi, BMW, Mercedes were there, Bentley as well, actually, and Porsche. Roll set his lap time in the Carrera GT. Now, clearly, he has a huge advantage because he was the development driver, a lot of that being at the Nürburgring. So off he went, does this lap time. Nobody else got within 20 seconds of him. And the other drivers were Tom Christensen, Klaus Ludwig, who was he's a triple DTM champion. So we're not talking about...
But he's also King Klaus. He's known as the King of the Nürburgring.
Yeah. So he was 19 seconds slower than Walter in the Carrera GT. Which around a 20 kilometre lap is a second a kilometre, which is a huge margin. And actually, I think probably more than anything, it shows you how tricky, certainly back then, the Carrera GT was. A tough, tough car to wring a lap time out of, particularly at a track like the Nürburgring.
Yeah.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact... You can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Can I do one?
Go on.
Okay, so we're back into the realms of, well, I know, I suppose, yeah, Walter very famous man. Gordon Murray.
Mm.
So Gordon is someone who I kind of, because I'm a child of the 70s, and I kind of grew up in the era of the sort of, you know, the Brabham Alphas and that sort of thing, and the cars that really put Gordon on the map, and then his time at Formula One with McLaren. So, I mean, he was already a massively famous guy when I first met him, which was when we road tested the F1, sort of 30 years ago. And going into a room and sitting down with Gordon Murray, it's like, what's it like? It's like going for a long, hot run and coming out really sweaty and somebody sitting you down with a really cold, clear glass of sparkling mineral water. Everything just becomes clear. Everything is just suddenly, you are so suddenly, the room is so full of innovation and ideas, and everything is doable. And I mean, he's a genuinely inspirational bloke. Because, you know, he's not a young man anymore. He must be in his late 70s. But even now, the way his mind works, I think he's probably the most consistently interesting person that I know, probably inside the industry or outside of the industry, just because he never, ever, he's just never boring. He never has anything mundane to say. He's always challenging. You can ask him a question, you can send him a sort of cow pat of a ball, just a really, really easy thing he can just swish away, and he'll come back with something totally unexpected. I don't know how much time you spent with him, but I mean, the idea of being Borden in the company of Gordon Murray at the same time is just literally inconceivable. And you look at his body of work and all that he has achieved, and the fact that even at his age now, you know, he is relentlessly pushing forward, always challenging existing thought, never settling for good enough, just pushing, pushing, pushing. And I wonder, for instance, if the McLaren F1 hadn't expanded the envelope of road car performance more than any other car in history before, probably since, I wonder what other road cars like that would be like now. Would people have really tried that hard? But by setting the new standard, by literally redefining what a road car could do, putting it on a level that not just that others had not been to before, but which they couldn't imagine, couldn't approach, everybody must have just gone, oh, okay, fine, we're here now, so this is what we need to deal with. And it all came out of that mind. And I just think he is, I mean, it's probably the most overused word in this and many other industries, but I really do think that Gordon Murray is a genius.
Oh, he is.
Absolutely stone-cold genius.
You can see it.
In technical terms.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You can see it in the T50. And actually, clearly the McLaren F1 was much the same. But when you look at the T50, when you stand by one, first of all, it's tiny. And then it has seating for three. And then you open up these storage compartments in the flanks, and they're enormous.
Mm.
And it's got a whacking great V12 that revs to 12,000. 12,000?
Yeah.
And it weighs, what is it, 1,000 kilograms or something? It's unbelievably light for a V12 supercar, hypercar. And you just think, how has this tiny operation, relatively speaking, Gordon Murray Automotive, been able to come up with this? And everyone else is building cars that are at least 300-500 kilograms heavier.
Yeah.
Seating for two, have no space for luggage or anything. It is extraordinary that Gordon Murray and the people he works with, obviously,
yeah,
that they've been able to produce something like that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the man is he's a genuine legend of the industry, and I'm very lucky. I think we are very lucky to you know, to know him and to, you know, get occasionally to spend time with him.
Mm. Let me offer Matej Rimac Everyone calls him Mate Rimac. Of course, it's actually Rimac or Rimac. He is Croatian. But Mate Rimac.
Never met the bloke, but I like what I've seen of him.
Yeah. So I met him, I think it was 2016. Here's a brag. I was the first journalist in the world to drive a Rimac. And this was long before the Nevera had been seen. This was when Rimac was really still a very small company establishing itself on the world stage. So I had Matty there for the entire day. We went off riding his electric bicycles. We went to lunch. Just had his company for the entire day. He's my age, this guy.
Yeah.
So I drove the Concept One, their 1,000 horsepower electric hypercar. I actually drove it the following day, and it was impressive in some ways, massively flawed in other ways. I actually just didn't fit. It was tiny. I'm only 6 foot tall. I'm not as tall as you, but I couldn't fit in it. It was deeply uncomfortable. So in some fairly fundamental ways, the car was massively flawed. But I saw the potential in it. But what I really saw was the potential in Rimac the company and in Matty, because he started to explain to me everything that the company was doing behind the scenes on the sort of business-to-business side with electric powertrains and battery technology. And even then, I was astonished at what he had been able to achieve, A, in a very small amount of time, just a few years, B, with no background of his own in the industry, and C, in Croatia. This would be hard enough to do in Warwickshire, you know? But to do it in Croatia,
yeah,
and I
and
I
by
remember,
that you're not by that you're not being rude about Croatia. You're just about finding the talent locally to do what you need to do. The suppliers,
yes, yeah.
It's just got this place with no history at all.
There's no industry
in that area
in automotive. Yeah,
yeah.
And I remember concluding that the interesting thing about the Concept One. And I reflect on this, it must have been so frustrating for them, because the way the car industry works, you design a car to the best of your capability, and then 2 years later it spat out the other side and people can drive it. And of course, in those 2 years, you learn so much, particularly as a young company, and your capability goes far beyond. So actually, they were all clearly quite embarrassed to be demonstrating the Concept One, when already their capability
in their heads, it was already an obsolete car,
massively obsolete. And he couldn't help but telling me every single time that the Concept 2, now the Nevera, is coming. It's going to be lighter. Well, I don't think it is lighter, but it's going to be better in this way, faster, everything else. And so he was clearly so frustrated at having to demonstrate what to him was already an obsolete vehicle. But I just remember thinking that this guy and this company, they are absolutely destined for big things. I couldn't believe what he'd achieved. And of course, now he controls Bugatti.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Talking of people controlling car companies, I've got another grouping here.
Yeah.
They're all either still are or have been recently heads of car companies. And that's not actually why I'm grouping them together. I'm grouping them together because you and I have sat in interviews with car industry executives who don't really want to be there, haven't really got very much to say, and you come out of them thinking, well, not only did that completely waste my time, but it actually completely wasted his time too. It was a completely pointless thing. These guys, you sit down with them and it's almost like a fireside chat. And what you become aware of after a bit is that they are quite actively and intentionally helping you do your job. Mm. And I appreciate that. So I actually, for reasons I won't bore you with, I had an hour with Adrian Hallmark yesterday, who is the boss of Bentley and the man who has transformed that business. Adrian, I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that he is a visionary, and his understanding of that brand and what is right for that brand is simply exceptional. But when we sit down and talk, he's phrasing his answers in a way, in ways that makes good copy, and he knows exactly how to tell you stuff you didn't know without, you know, giving away state secrets. He's always interesting. He's always got little anecdotes. He's always backing up his statements with examples. And he's just a dream interview because, you know, he basically writes the story for you. You can almost just transcribe the notes and publish them. And another bloke who did that, I've got two people, Mike Fluitt from McLaren, who's not there anymore, and Andy Palmer from Aston Martin, who's not there anymore. And they've both had, copped an awful lot of flack for some of the things that they did while they were in charge of their companies. And I'm sure that mistakes were made, and I'm not saying who's right, who's wrong. What I will say is that both of them, when you sat down and you talked to them, were endlessly interesting, and you always came away knowing your time had been well spent. I can't tell you how much I appreciate that. It's just, you know, as a journalist, you know, these guys aren't my friends. These are people who, you know, I like and I know, and I like to think that I get along with, but ultimately it's a relationship where, you know, they want something out of it because they wouldn't have put themselves up for it if they didn't think there was something for them. I need something out of it because I've got a living to earn, and they understand that, and you kind of like, you work together, and it's people who are considerate like that. More than anything else, I just think they're smart. I just think that they sit down with a journalist and come away with something which works for both sides. It's just good business, and I just appreciate them taking the time to take you seriously.
Yeah, we've all come up against the opposite of that, people who make it very, very difficult.
And there's
a waste of everyone's time.
There's a great one. Ola Källenius, and I'm not putting him forward. I do know him and he does know me, but I'm not saying that he's one of the greatest people I've ever met. But what he is world-class at, I got to know him a bit when he was head of AMG, and he's now head of Mercedes-Benz. He's the head honcho at Mercedes-Benz. And if you sit down with him and you interview him, he has this extraordinary technique. You can talk to him for whatever you get, half an hour, 40 minutes, whatever. And you can sit there and you just think, this is going brilliantly. This is going so well. He's chatting away and he's talking and he's talking and he's talking, and it's fantastic. And, you know, you're just thinking, front. And you go back and you transcribe the tapes and you realize he said absolutely nothing. It's genius. He completely engages you. He's charming. He's such great company. And yet you come away with absolutely nothing.
No story.
I mean, completely brilliant. Whereas his predecessor, Dieter Zetscher, was completely the reverse. His interviews could be, you know, a little bit dry, but he always said stuff. And frankly, I'd just rather have people who told me stuff, whether they were, you know, great company or not.
Yeah, that's right. So as you mentioned, I've knocked about with quite a lot of rally people. Certainly at the very start of my career, before I'd ever had a full-time job, actually, I was doing a lot of rally stuff. And a little bit later as well. And the fun thing about rallying, even at the highest level, is that there's a sort of humility about everyone because it's not Formula One. And so everyone is so accessible. And if you're in that world, it is a small world, and everyone is available. So as a sort of 20-year-old rookie cub reporter, didn't really know anything, didn't know what I was doing, but I had time with David Richards, Pro Drives David Richards, with Malcolm Wilson from M Sport, the co-drivers as well, Robert Reed, who I've got to know really well. He's a great guy. Nicky Grist, and David Lapworth as well. And I remember having dinner with David Lapworth, who is on the engineering side. He's David Richards' right hand man at Pro Drive, and we were talking about what makes Sebastian Loeb so quick in a rally car. And he was the first person who's ever been able to explain it to me.
Yeah.
And he says that what Loeb does is when he's in the car and he's trying to go faster, he doesn't push harder, which is what everyone else does. They push harder. They try to go faster. Loeb tries to drive more perfectly because every corner has a perfect entry point and entry speed, braking point, throttle on point, line, all the rest of it. And Loeb is the only one who was able to, certainly at the time, who was able to see all of that stuff and drive more perfectly. All the others, if they were losing time or they had time to make up, they would push harder and probably go a bit slower. But Loeb would drive more perfectly.
There's a great quote. I'm going to get it completely wrong, but I'll get the gist of it, which came from Jim Clark, who said, "When I want to go quicker, I don't try to drive faster. I concentrate more."
Mm, same thing, isn't it?
That's exactly it, isn't it?
Oh, fantastic. I love that stuff.
Yeah.
I do love that stuff.
Actually, and although I'm not into the rallying and to anything like the same extent here. In fact, the only time I've ever spent in that world at all was right at the beginning of this year, when I was very lucky to go and chase the Dakar for a few days.
Yeah.
But it's exactly what you say. It's the accessibility of it. Mm. And the fact that, okay, so the two guys who I guess, well, Loeb is doing it now, but Loeb aside, in the Dakar world, the two intergalactic superheroes are Nasser Al-Attiyah and Stefan Pettersson.
Yeah.
And you could just, you go into, you know, when all the cars are there lying around, either about to start or usually when they've just finished a stage, and they're just mucking about and they're chatting. You just walk up to them and they'll talk to you for as long as you like.
Mm.
It is so far removed from the world of Formula One. And they're always, you know, they actually seem a bit sort of touched that you're interested in them and what they've got to say. And they will. I can remember Nasser just chatting about everything, about, you know, where he'd come from, where he thought he was going to go to. And again, you just really appreciate them taking the time, don't you?
Mm. Oh, you do. They're good people. Do you want to give us another?
Well, we mentioned Preuninger, didn't we, briefly?
Yep, yep.
So Andreas Preuninger, everybody will know who he is, but just in case you've never looked at the intercooler or never read anything about Porsche, he's, you know, for the last, gosh, it must be 20 years, been sort of, you know, the man who has certainly the public face and largely behind all the GT cars. So from the second generation of the 996 GT3, he wasn't involved with the very first one, and every GT3, GT2, GT4 that's come out since has had his fingerprints all over it. When you meet Andy, it's the warmth, and then it's the intellect, and again, he just has this incredibly clear thought process. And he listens, and I guess more than anything else, he just makes brilliant cars, doesn't he? This sounds like such a sort of loving, doesn't it? But that's the purpose of the podcast, isn't it? You know, it's not just people who we got along with reasonably well or thought was quite bright. These are the guys who we really, really live up to, and respect. And I don't think I've ever heard anyone say a bad word about Preuninger. There are plenty of people I've already mentioned who I've heard plenty of people have some very bad words say about. I don't think I've ever heard anyone diss Preuninger or say, "Oh, don't you think he's a bit overrated?" Or actually, it wasn't all him, or anything like that. Everybody just loves the guy,
just respects the guy. Yeah. I've got a couple that I just want to mention very quickly. Andy Wallace is just the best company.
Yes.
Le Mans winner with Jaguar in 88, I think.
Yeah.
88. And McLaren F1 and, excuse me, and Bugatti test driver. Fantastic guy. And whenever you spend time with him, particularly if you have dinner with him, he just reels off these amazing stories. He's a fantastic storyteller. And we've done a couple of podcasts with him. We did a Last Blast and he was on episode 155. And listen to those and you just get a sense of what the guy's like. He's just fantastic company. You mentioned one of these two, but whenever I spend time with Matt Becker or Gav Kershaw,
yeah,
and we're talking about cars, we're talking about vehicle dynamics, I basically want to have a notepad out or a voice recording app or something going, because everything they say is just insightful and enlightening. You just learn so much, even from a short conversation with those guys.
Gav Kershaw being the person who basically took over from Matt as the head of chassis engineering at Lotus.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they are, they're fantastic at what they do. They're also just super friendly guys who love cars.
Okay. Well, I mean, we're going to have to wrap this up soon, or at least get on to some of the people we don't like. But while we're going through, I'm going to say a shout out. I'm not even going to mention their names because no one's going to have heard of any of them. But they are the best bunch of guys I've ever worked with. These are the guys who look after the Porsche Museum cars. These are the guys who, time after time, strap me into stupid stuff and just tell me to get on with it. And the trust is absolutely... I mean, I think of some of the stuff they've let me drive, and no one has ever said, Andrew, you need to be careful with this, or Andrew, you can't use more than this sort of res, or Andrew, you know, we're relying on you not to stuff this up. They just go, here's a 1,000 horsepower 972, go and enjoy it. And they are, and when you come back and you've got that smile on your face, and they really don't care if you're in a 917-30 or a single cylinder Porsche tractor, if you come back with a smile on your face, they will love you forever. And they are the best bunch of people that I've ever, you know, other than the people that I've worked on, you know, because we're employed by the same organization, that I just sort of randomly come across every couple of years, you know, twice a year or whatever. Part to me of the entire enjoyment of going and driving some of those cars, whether it's, you know, the Festival of Speed or a Revival or whatever, is just knowing I'm going to get to hang out with those guys. Who else? Oh, yeah, just quick shout out for Jochen Mass, only because I think he is, for reasons which got nothing whatever to do with cars, the most interesting racing driver I've ever spent a bit of time with. He is massively intelligent. He's a polymath. He knows so much about everything. And he's just one of the... I once got stuck at the top of the hill with him. I say stuck. I couldn't have been happier. I was in a 959. He'd driven me up the hill in the 959. I think someone behind us crashed. And it was chucking it down with rain. And so we were stuck in a 959 for about 40 minutes. And he just talked. And we talked about politics, and we talked about apartheid, and we talked about wine, and we talked about food. I think the only thing we didn't talk about was cars. I never said to him, what was it like to be James Hunt's teammate? And you just sit there and you just realise that this man is so informed and urbane, and it's just a great bloke to spend some time with. Okay, is that the end of the love-in?
You're right, it has been a love-in. We need to redress that balance a little bit, don't we?
Okay.
I feel terrible about this, but we're going to have to do it. Should I go first?
Well, how many have you got?
I've got two, but they're quite brief.
Okay, I don't feel bad about any of mine.
Okay.
I may have more than that. I'm not going to go through all of them because, you know, we're not here to give people a kicking. I can't say that Ron Dennis exactly endeared himself to me. On the only time that we've ever been aware of each other's existence, or certainly the only time he's ever been aware of my existence. And to be fair, I was kind of gate-crashing his events, but I'd been told, this was in early 94, to go to the Nürburgring where McLaren was demonstrating the F1, this is long before anybody had driven it, to new customers. And Jonathan Palmer was just scaring them witless around the new Nürburgring track. And I turned up there, and Ron obviously had no idea I was coming. I'm not even sure we told McLaren. We must have done a deal with someone who said, oh, well, we won't tell Ron, but if you turn up, we'll see what we can do. And we just thought, we just did it speculatively. And he was so rude to me. I can't remember exactly what he was talking about, but I can remember going on about being a company director, and this is what directors got to do. And the inference wasn't difficult to draw from that. I wasn't a company director at the time. I was a junior envelope licker at auto car. he made me feel pretty bloody small.
Oh, yes, actually, there you go. I can relate to that.
Go on.
So very, very respected, very well-known car designer, Peter Schreyer.
Yeah, Kia.
One of the guys involved in the original Audi TT, now at Kia. Clearly a great car designer. Look, see what he's done at Kia. You know, Kia before and after Peter Schreyer is just night and day, isn't it? But I was in Korea to see the new Kia Stinger. And I was told to get an interview with Peter Schreyer, asking him to explain the Stinger to me. And so I said hello, introduced myself. I think I was polite. And I said, we were standing next to the car, and I said, so tell me about the stinger. And he gave me a word or two, hopeless. And so I'm trying to, you know, draw something more out of him. And to be fair, it's a terrible question, but I was just trying to get him to talk a little bit more. So I said to him, do you have a favourite part of the car? And he just very directly, quite rudely, just said, it's something like, it's a single car, it doesn't have parts or something. You know, he doesn't think of it as having parts or styling elements. It's a whole, it's a cohesive whole. And he clearly just thought I was a total moron. And he didn't try at all to disguise that.
But how does that serve his purpose?
I don't know.
It doesn't, does it?
No.
Everybody loses. If someone behaves like that, everybody, including the person behaving like that, loses.
Yeah.
It's so silly.
It was hopeless. It was unnecessary. You know, he could have just taken literally 2 minutes just to explain a bit more about the car, why they did what they did, but he just couldn't be bothered. He could be bothered.
Okay, I'm going to... Well, I feel a bit bad about this because I know a couple of people who know him a bit and say that, A, he's not like this, and if he was like this then, he's certainly not like this now. So I'm talking about Nigel Mansell.
Mm.
Yeah. But, you know, and I certainly know someone who spent a bit of time with him recently who said he was actually absolutely charming. Couldn't have been nicer. But I've only really had one exchange with him, which was on the 10th anniversary of Senna's death. So this would have been 2004. I was commissioned to do a story, Autocar, Motorsport, don't know who the client was. Anyway, and I basically rang up a load of people who were in one way or another, either because they, you know, designed his cars or were his teammates or were his rivals or whatever, a load of people, just to give me a few memories of Senna. And everybody, and I can remember talking to Dick Bennett of West Sturridge Racing and talking to Murray and, you know, to Martin and all the usual suspects. And everybody gave me all the time in the world. And couldn't have been more charming. And then I tried to get hold of Mansell and couldn't, and got his PA, who said, I'll ask. And I then got, I guess it would have been a fax then, saying, Mr. Mansell has agreed to talk to you at this time on this day, but he needs to see all your questions in advance, and then he'll talk to you. So, well, you know, I've got to have the bloke. So I wrote down a list, sent it across. And to be fair to Nigel, the telephone rang to the minute. And he went, right, question one, blah, question two, blah, question three, blah. And not only was he as short and as curt and as rude as he could possibly be, the entire thrust of what he was saying was to somehow imply that he thought he'd at least as good at, if not a better racing driver than Ayrton Senna. And it was so self-serving. And when he got to the end of it, he said, right, that's it. And that was it. And then he just hung up. And it was so unnecessary. It was so unnecessary. But, you know, maybe I caught him on a bad day. And again, I suspect it's one of these things where if he knows you or he feels relaxed with you, as we observed earlier with, you know, with Loeb and with Senna, I'm sure he's a very, very different person. But he's always had a difficult relationship with the media, famous Russell Bulgin story to name but one. But
I met him when I was really just starting out in this industry. I don't know, it must have been 19 or something. And it was super cool to be in his company. But you're right, that point about everything that he said seemed to be, suggesting or trying to give you the impression that he was the finest racing driver of all time.
Yeah.
he did seem to have that view. So my last one, and I'll be very, very quick about this, was Hannu Mikkola, 1983 World Rally Champion. I know. And again, this was years ago. I was probably 18 or something. And this was rally day at Castle Coombe. And I'd gone along to try and do some work, earn a few quid maybe. And Mikkola just had zero time for me and had no interest in talking to me. I think he answered a couple of my questions very quickly and then just toddled off. And it's just a shame. It's just a shame when, particularly as a young person, when you're meeting someone that you admire because they won the World Rally Championship,
yeah,
and they just don't care. They just don't care.
Yeah. And contrasting that, I think I've mentioned this story before, and this has got nothing to do with me, but I was once asked to go round the Drivers' Club at the Festival of Speed, asking various drivers what the greatest thing they'd seen all weekend was. And I remember asking Sterling what the greatest thing he'd seen that weekend was, and he said, Jenson Button. Mm. And I said, why? Well, I didn't see his run. Was he amazing? And he said, no, it's got nothing to do with that at all. When he got to the top, you know what it's like at the top of the hill. All the drivers get out and have a chat with each other. And he said, Jenson didn't do that. He went straight over to the spectator stand. And for the half an hour we were up there, all he did was talk to the fans and sign autographs. Mm. Nobody else was doing it. And Sterling just thought that and thought, proper.
Mm. Yeah, it's fantastic, isn't it? It says a lot about JB, yeah. Well, I have got a listener question, but I'm not going to do it this week. I'm going to save it because we are going to time out.
We are. I think we have.
I think that was quite a good topic. Hopefully not too much of a love-in. I think we did...
Oh, we could do it occasionally.
I know. We ended on a cynical note, so there we go. But there we go. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Do get your listener questions across. Keep them coming because we like ending the podcast that way most weeks. And I promise we will do so next week.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud. Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.